Hey everybody, welcome to Radio Free Nintendo. This is episode 410. I'm your host, Jonathan Metz, and with me as always are John Lindemann.
Hey, hey. What's going on, people?
Hey, James Jones.
Where's the energy? What's with you guys?
I'm in a bit of a public space, so I'm trying not to speak really loudly or too excitedly. I don't want to scare people.
I'm just being quiet out of respect, James.
John is a public space.
You guys don't have to be quiet on my account. I'll just probably be a little quieter than I usually am. And Guillaume Veillette.
I'm not in the public space. I just need a vacation.
Yeah, well, I don't know if you would want the kind of vacation I've had for over the past couple of days. As some people probably saw on Twitter, I am moving to Las Vegas for a new job. And I'm doing it during the holidays on short notice. So,
which is a real pain in the ass.
Yeah, it's all very complicated, and my schedule right now is totally crazy. So I've been driving a lot, and then today I was like all over Las Vegas looking at apartments, not doing a single one of the things that most people would want to do in Las Vegas. And now I am in the business center of my hotel because the internet is stronger there than it is in my room. So it's just one of the stranger places I've recorded RFN, although outside on campus at USC was probably my favorite. That was one of the best. Yeah. Just outside the Student Union Center at the campus of USC. That was pretty good. Anyway, let's get started, guys. We have a lot to talk about, a lot of good games, up a new business, and then we're going to catch up on listener mail later. Although going through the list, we realized we're way more behind. We have way more good, fun listener mails than we actually have time to do this week. And so we're going to try to do a little catch up, like real catch up on that, maybe next time. And so we might even do just like an all email show, just to try to do a whole bunch of them. So, and we haven't done that since the telethon, I guess.
Right.
Which we didn't even get through as many as I wanted to there because we were doing call-ins and some of them went long, as it happens. Anyway, we will do emails later on, but first, new business. And James, I thought maybe you should go first this week.
All right. So last week I spoke about the Phoenix Wright collection. Still playing it, obviously, because it's a shit lot of game to get through.
Yeah, it's only three games in one. Even for you, that might take a week.
And with other stuff, it's not really been able to get played a whole lot. But one thing that I have kind of gotten a little bit of a kick out of doing is trying to use the Miiverse on 3DS, which they patched in less than a year ago, I think. It may be about a year ago that 3DS got Miiverse.
It seems
Miiverse.
Like it's been about a year. Yeah, I mean, I use it occasionally, but it's so slow.
Yeah,
I don't open it up that often.
It's kind of neat that they were able to patch it into the system, but it's not. You know, it's not as deeply integrated on anything as the Wii U one is.
Well, the reports are that on the new 3DS, it loads up much faster.
And I would expect it would.
And I believe you can do it during Smash Brothers, which is disabled on the older hardware. So it seems like new 3DS, it seems like that might be one of the features that they push is that, hey, Miiverse works better, it's faster, it loads up way faster, and it's kind of not a hassle to use, which currently I would say it's a bit of a hassle. It's probably,
yeah, I mean, they haven't, they've,
you know, it's nice for people. I think they mainly did it for people who don't own a Wii U, who wanted Miiverse. You know?
They never really pushed the Miiverse in any capacity, Wii U, 3DS, whatever. It's just something that they kind of talked about during you know, Nintendo Directs and stuff, but they've never really given any kind of real muscle behind it. So I'd be curious if they ever would. It just, you know, as a product, it doesn't really seem like it's that big of a deal. But what is kind of nice here is that because you can take these nice 3D screenshots of the top screen, well, they're 3D when you view them on 3DS. We view them on like your PC or Wii U. They're 2D, mm-hmm. obviously. But you can take screenshots of the game. And as I'm going through these games and realizing that Capcom's discussion about things they've improved besides the graphics are just complete and utter bullshit, I'd expect no less.
Wait, which parts are BS?
Oh, so they talked about like music's been remastered. Well, no, not really. You're just not using chiptunes because they're just recordings of the chiptunes, you assholes.
Is the translation not any better either?
I haven't discerned that it is significantly better in any way. There's still a character that talks in 2004 leet speak. Huh? I mean, it's still there. I mean, granted, people who are fans of the series would probably be upset if it wasn't.
But see, it's more true to leet speak, though. I mean, You're just not part of that community. That's why you don't understand.
Yeah, I just left that community. And
have you noticed any typos, James?
I haven't, but I didn't tend to notice them in originally anyway.
Oh, really? Oh, I did. You must just race through that dialogue.
I do.
Yeah, because I can speed read. So I just go right through it real fast. So when you speed read...
Wait, you can speed read?
Yeah.
This explains a lot. Especially about this game. Because my big problem with the Ace Attorney series, there's too many words. It just takes too long to do anything. Because every character, you know, uses 10 pages of writing to get across a point.
And the thing about when you speed read, and I'm not the best speed reader, but I can do it reasonably well, is that you're not really reading every word, but your brain's able to kind of fill in the words that you jump.
Well, and also it helps that in that game they repeat everything 3 times.
Yeah, but so I still noticed that. I still noticed that.
If you miss it the first time, you're going to catch it.
Yeah, but I still caught it. And I noticed, okay, we're talking about it again. But like, so typos and stuff, your brain just sort of looks at the shape of the word and just sort of instantly knows what the word is. So a typo you might miss because the shape's still there and the context is still there, so your brain's still going to plug in the right word. But what I've been doing instead is as I'm kind of taking the game a little bit slowly. I'm only through about 3 cases. So I'm going to memes in the series that I remember, ones that they from this first game have then filtered through the remainder of the series. A good example is the discussion about ladders versus stepladders, which is this dumb joke that Maya makes when Phoenix corrects her that that's not a ladder, it's a stepladder. And she makes a joke. She makes a comment about he shouldn't base his cultural assumptions and with labeling things. It's really weird and kind of backhanded joke about some kinds of, you know, political commentary and being, you know, political correctness a little bit, you know, it's a little bit biting for this game in terms of its commentary. So of course that joke then gets repeated throughout the series in perpetuity forever. Like, they're constantly just ladders in your face all the time. So you can hear them talk about, well, that's actually a stepladder, and then some character goes completely off the handle about it. So I'm just putting up screenshots of these kinds of moments. You know, things that are going to come up again, jokes that people will probably remember, just to see, almost as an experiment, what happens on my Miiverse Yaz. And what I've concluded is that there are certain Ace Attorney jokes that just people like more than others, and now I'm worried that maybe Capcom's just going to go read my Miiverse and just make all those jokes over again, because I got a ton of yes for the ladders, didn't get a whole lot for Charlie the ficus, which is a plant that they treat like a character.
Just isn't like, that like a reference to Maniac Mansion, or am I...
It is, but okay. they take it to some bizarre, because in Maniac Mansion it's Chuck.
Right.
And this one, they just keep going with it for the entire series. Yeah. To the point where, but it's never important ever, and you could totally miss it every single time. But you know, just these little things that it's kind of amusing to see people go like, "Yeah, I remember that joke. That joke's really funny." Or, "Yeah, I remember that joke. Fuck that game." Like it's really, there's a point of just seeing there are people who get this series at that same level that I do, who have these kind of really vivid moment in time memories, and for once, that's kind of a neat thing for the Miiverse. It's not really pictures and stuff, people commenting. It's just. Of the ones I'm posting, and I'm posting, you know, a decent number of them, you can see that some of them people just, I'll get a ton of yas on, and other ones, nobody even notices.
It sounds like you've turned Miiverse into your own, like, Big Lebowski quotation website from circa 2001.
A little bit. It's just kind of like, and it's not, taking screenshots isn't the most fun thing to do in Miiverse, but, you know, I could do one in 10, 15 seconds. So it's, all right, let me get the screenshots real quick. Okay, it's posted there. I mean, usually it's...
But you can't usually post it in 15 seconds.
No, but I can get the screenshot and just type up my comment and hit save. And then it sits for a minute, and then I jump back into the game. But at this game, because there's no action, I mean, action in quotes there, it's you could kind of get away with taking brief pauses and doing this and coming back. And the game will just wait for you to take your screenshot. So it's been, you know, kind of a neat way to sort of experience this game a little bit differently, because it is ultimately a game that I've played, you know, a half dozen times.
Yeah, I mean, at some point you have to kind of go a little bit meta with it, right? That's why people do speed runs or, you know,
and this is a series that is aware that its fans play it a lot of times. It does occasionally put these weird in jokes that may go back to games and just to see, hey, do you remember this? Do you remember this dumb shit we did? Here it is.
But they've never done anything where the game actually changes when you play it a second time, have they?
No, they haven't.
There's no 999 kind of craziness going on.
The only thing that you can change is at the end of cases for most of the games, your client will come up and they're usually depressed about whoever it was that betrayed them or whoever it was that got murdered, and you have to kind of present one piece of evidence to make them feel better about themselves, and you can fuck that up. And the game doesn't stop, it just goes on. And so that's really the only difference you get. It's like, hey, and sometimes it's not totally clear what that evidence is, and you have to think about it a little differently. But it doesn't really change the game.
Okay.
But beyond that, I've been playing another game with, I'll call it Capcom Lineage, but not directly, in Bayonetta 2. Which is, I mean, it is Bayonetta 1, but the production values are hugely improved. A certain amount of this obviously is hardware, but some of it just feels like Nintendo just said, just go nuts. Just do what you want. I don't care. Be crazy.
Well, you say hardware, but I mean, it's not immediately apparent for most people, I think, that the Wii U is that much more powerful than, say, the Xbox 360, first Bayonetta runs on.
If you compare the Bayonetta 1 on Wii U to Bayonetta 2 on Wii U, there is a noticeable visual quality difference.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Cool.
And it's like the character models just look so much more detailed and so much sharper and more smooth. There's a lot less just weird, like, artifacting and alias outlines. It just looks a lot better.
Well, and Bayonetta 2 has always looked good. Every time we saw it at E3, it was always like, wow, I don't really know what's going on, and I don't know if I want that game, but it sure does look nice.
Yep. And it's so I've gone through, I don't know, about a third of the game at this point. And obviously these games meant to be replayed, and I'll go back and replay 1 and 2 at some point in the near future. But right now I'm trying to get through games for the holidays so I can talk about them on this show. And God, I'm glad I played 1 first, because the opening of 2 just rains jokes from 1 on you. And if you were a huge fan of Bayonetta 1, like, the opening experience of 2 must have been just nearly, I mean, after all those years, been just nearly a religious experience. Because they hit all the notes of the stuff that was funny and endearing about the first game and its characters, and just nail them so much more perfectly. And I mean, the entire opening sequence is Bayonetta out shopping for Christmas gifts, which is the dumbest concept ever. And it ends with her fighting a bunch of Heaven's angels on the back of an F-16 flying through a city.
Yeah, well, we've seen that part. That's in the demo also that you can download.
It is. Yeah, it's like it goes from there to there with really no bridge. It just kind of happens.
It's like from there, it gets really weird.
Yeah, it does too. And that's not even the weirdest part of the intro. It gets even weirder. It's the game is so self-aware. It's I just really enjoy that about it. It plays great. It is an incredibly fun game. I am getting hugely frustrated, but in the way the game intends for you to be frustrated. But it's just experiencing the dumb stuff like that has been really fun, and just how this game manages to keep its own personality, even when irreverence is such a big deal of how it, you know, presents itself, while still maintaining enough seriousness that you could be somewhat engaged in this completely nonsensical story. I enjoy it. I really think this is really one of my favorite Wii U games this year. I didn't expect that.
That's good to hear, because I just bought it too, even though I shouldn't be buying games right now. There was a Best Buy deal on eShop cards, and I figured, well, I'm going to buy these very soon after the new year regardless. I might as well do it now while I can get a deal on the cards and still get my DDP credit, you know, the digital deluxe program.
Yep.
So I figured, you know, it kind of translates out to about $20 off doing it now versus doing it later. So it makes more sense to do it now.
I bought a few of those. I've mostly been spending them on 3DS stuff, but it's thank God those things are on the same wallet now. Because deals like this are so much more lucrative now.
Yeah. And it also makes more sense to, you know, like when cards go on sale, which seems to happen 2 or 3 times a year, you know, especially, you know, big companies like Best Buy especially will put the eShop cards on sale. You can stock up and just throw them in your account, like go ahead and redeem them and not even know what you're going to spend it on later. Because it works across both platforms, you don't have to commit. Which you used to have to do, right? It used to be you could use the code on either one,
They were Nintendo points that then became Nintendo 3DS, Nintendo 3DS shop points or WiiWare points. Yeah, and I mean, I dumped three or four cards into that thing and just said, all right, all set.
There's a limit of $200, by the way.
Really?
Yeah, you can't have more.
Yeah,
I had a really good Target sale at some point, and I found out.
It's probably like just for kids. They don't want kids going on there and using their parents' credit card or something.
Yeah, I would think that $200, though, will probably get you pretty close to the next sale.
Oh, in terms of, just buying what you want between then and whenever the next time you can
I enjoy using the eShop cards from Best Buy on the sale because I also get Best Buy reward points for them, which I then use to buy more eShop cards.
Yes.
You're a madman.
I kind of ended up following the same plan out of, I guess you might say serendipity. After the flood, I lived with a friend for a couple months who was much closer to Best Buy than before, and I had to replace a lot of stuff from Best Buy that I lost in the flood. So I ended up earning a bunch of points on that stuff. I mean, I had to buy a Wii U there, and I had a bunch of stuff, a bunch of cables and hard drives. And so, yeah, I ended up earning a whole bunch of Best Buy credit, which, of course, I used to buy eShop cards. Because it's like, you have $15 worth of Best Buy credit. Well, I'm not going to go spend $15 on anything at Best Buy. But I can buy a $15 eShop card, and I know I'll use that probably that day. So it's easy. It is a good deal.
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm having fun. This game could be... If you're not experienced with these games, I strongly encourage you to play 1 and 2 on the easy mode the first time. Just sort of get a feel for it. And also because you'll be able to buy upgrades to make it more manageable going forward. So it's a good way to kind of get warmed up to it. I resisted. You could change your difficulty anytime. So if you want to start on normal and jump back down, that's totally cool. But eventually it just made sense for me to drop down. And I've been having way more fun since I did it both times. So
interesting. I was kind of thinking I might play the first one on easy to learn it. And then I might play 2 on normal. Get away with it.
You'll earn a ton more money on easy because you get a higher ranking because you die less times, and then that means you get more stuff to buy upgrades. I mean, I went back and played 1 on normal afterwards, and A, I was better at the game, but B, Bayonetta herself was just way more useful, so it helped. I don't regret it.
Cool. Alrighty. Well, Guillaume, what have you been playing?
Yeah, I've been playing Donkey Kong Jungle Climber. And that's a game I never played on the...
GBA game?
Yeah. Yeah, well, it came out recently on the eShop. So, on the Wii U eShop, of course.
Weird.
Yeah, I had skipped it because the reviews didn't make it look all that enticing. And just, it's a weird concept. If anyone's never even heard of it, it's this game where you control Donkey Kong, and it's kind of a platformer, but you're not really jumping and running. Instead, you've got these pegs, really, like these, you know, circles sticking out in the background. And Donkey Kong latches onto them, and just starts spinning. He spins and spins and spins as long as you hold like the L and R triggers. And so like the left and right triggers could like basically close his hands. And that's how you control the game.
There's a mode similar to that in Wii Fit U.
What?
Yeah.
Oh, you mean the rock and roll climber mode?
Yes, which is, I think, pretty fun. It's tricky because you're using the balance board and you have to have 2 Wii Remote pluses.
So yep.
And you're kind of doing a lot of weird, it's hard to coordinate, but that's sort of the point. And it's actually pretty fun. And it always reminds me of these games. Cause there's also, isn't there also King of Swing for DS?
There is. Is that the same type of game?
I don't even know.
I think it's the sequel. Yeah, DK King of Swing. I think it's the sequel to Jungle Climber.
Maybe.
Maybe an alternate title, but yeah.
I think King of Swing is I want to say that's a GBA game. I want to say it's Payon made.
Yeah, but Payon made both of them. And then they made that racing game Barrel Blast for Wii, which is terrible.
Right. Okay, well, I don't know about King of Swing. I
think it's a GBA game.
It does look the exact... It looks like the exact same game.
Yeah, DK Kangol Swing is GBA.
Yep.
Maybe okay. They're both on GBA. Maybe they made a sequel on the same platform.
DK Jungle Climber is the... So Jungle Climber is the sequel of King of Swing.
What?
Are you kidding me?
Why would they release that one?
Because King of Swing's like 5 levels long.
Right. Oh, okay, really? Well, getting back to Jungle Climber, which you can get on the Wii U right now, and I don't think that you can get King of Swing.
Jungle Climber is the DS game. There we go.
Wait.
Okay, no. So I am playing King of Swing. I got this all wrong. I'm sorry.
Okay, yeah, Jungle Climber is the DS game. King of Swing is the GBA game.
Fuck.
So you're playing King of Swing.
I'm playing King of Swing, apparently. Okay, so I've been...
It's the podcast, people.
Let me just say...
There are people yelling at us for the last 5 minutes.
No. Like, I'm just going to splice the next part like at the beginning. So I've been playing Donkey Kong
Covering Swing.
Hey, I thought it was a fun little investigation there.
Yeah, I love it.
Seriously.
Oh, boy.
That was interesting.
So it's a really weird concept, and it's kind of funny because we talked in the last two podcasts of physics-y titles, like games where the physics are kind of unpredictable. This is almost too precise. Like, it's precise to a fault. I kind of wish that it had more unpredictable physics going on, because then it would mean that the game would be perhaps a little bit more forgiving. But it's this really exacting... weird kind of new platformer. And so you grab these pegs, and Donkey Kong keeps spinning around them at a constant speed. It makes no goddamn sense. And so...
Because the fact he wears a tie is perfectly normal.
Right. Well, actually, that's kind of cool, because there's a special effect. Like, the tie is always drawn, like, gravity affects it. So when he's upside down, the tie is, you know, hanging... over his head. It's kind of cute.
But if he was rotating around a circular point, wouldn't the tie move with him?
Who cares? The point is they animated the tie independently of Donkey Kong.
I care!
There's a lot of neat touches in that game like that. But yeah, like, just how do you get across the way it plays? Like, it's really... So yeah, you're constantly spinning around this peg, and what you can do, if you want to stop yourself, you've got to find another peg that you can grab with the other hand, or you let go... And DK is just going to jump, basically, in the direction that you're heading. So using that technique, you can swing from peg to peg. And at first, like, the stages are very forgiving. Instead of just, like, one unique peg that you have to grab and you have to be very precise, it's going to be kind of like this climbing wall. And so, like, anywhere in that surface, you can hit L and R, and you're going to grab something. So it's very forgiving, but very quickly, the game just becomes a bastard. And not only have to grab individual pegs, which are tougher to grab because they're smaller, of course, but also, like, those pegs could be moving around, or they could be, like, there's a big variety of themes in the game. And, like, in the water world, for instance, at some point you're going to be climbing a waterfall, and the pegs are just, you know, cascading down the waterfall. So it's, you know, at irregular intervals, and it's really, really demanding. It's really, really tough. But the cool thing is you do get better at it. Like, I was struggling at first just with, like, level 1-1, and, you know, I was struggling getting through the game. But when you go back to that first level, you're like, pfft, like, it's so easy, and you can just, like, speedrun it, and you can't believe that you were struggling initially. But yeah, so I made it through the game, and I don't think I was really having fun. Like, it's a game where, like, it's really interesting. It's really a concept that I had never really seen before or since. And I know
Clu-Clu
the game.
That's because you never play Clu-Clu Land.
No, but the game has so much more going on than Clu-Clu Land. Like, Clu-Clu Land, it's a very simplistic game. It's just kind of a maze game.
Well, you can only let go in the four cardinal directions in Clu-Clu Land. But King of Swing, I mean, the big thing there is that it's 360. So as DK is swinging around these pegs, wherever you let go, he flies off in a tangent in that direction. And so you, as you described, you have to be a lot more accurate with, mm-hmm. and pay more attention to his momentum and things like that.
Sure, but like DK, like you don't have a time limit. Like in Clue Clue Land, you're always moving and you can't stop. In DK, sometimes, at least like your first time through a level, you have to be much more deliberate. You have to take your time. You have to find a spot where you can just take a breather and examine what's going on, the patterns of the enemies, and then try to make your move. And yeah, so it's a completely different feel. I was impressed by the variety of the levels, but also the variety of the actions, because at first I thought, like, the reason why I skipped this game initially years ago is because it just looked too simplistic, right? You're just spinning around these pegs and that's a game. But they managed to cram in a couple of neat ideas, like you can grab rocks that are just floating there, and then like you can try to send them at enemies or like to break barrels with them, and like it does add kind of a new mechanic like every couple of level like that. And they've also got, I don't know, like the underwater stages, they change the physics a little bit, and that's enough to kind of revitalize the experience once again, you know. And then there's the ice level, which, you know, like if you despise ice levels and platformers, you will absolutely hate DK King of Swing, because like imagine like the climbing walls that I talked about earlier, like make them much smaller and make them slippery. And then like you have to kind of like feather the L and R buttons. Like you have to make sure that you're grabbing and then like don't let go and try to spin the right way and grab with the other hand. And I don't know. It's really, really surprising for a game. Like but the game is more interesting than it is fun. Like, on Twitter, JP Carbrin from the website, said it. Exactly. Like it's interesting, but I can't say that I'm really enjoying the game when I'm playing it. I'm really frustrated and I'm kind of impressed, and there's a lot of neat graphical touches and gameplay touches, but in the end, like perhaps I would have been better off looking at a Let's Play or something like the kids do.
Well, since they're...
So remember, kids, if you watch Let's Plays, Guillaume Veillette hates you.
Since there are DS games coming to Wii U at some point, supposedly, other than Brain Training in Japan, there's a possibility that the sequel to this game could also be released on Virtual Console. Is it a case where you might want to play the sequel just to see what other ideas they found to cake on top of this basic concept, or you feel like you've had more than enough of this idea?
Well, at first, I would make sure they actually found new ideas to put into this sort of game.
So I'm looking at the description right now, and I didn't bother to look at that, but I did notice there's a 5-paragraph plot description of the sequel.
Whoa.
What? Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Take it to the next level. What can you say?
No, I'm looking at screenshots right now. It looks like, you know, the GBA game is very cartoony. It's pixel art. And in the DS game, it looks like they went with the Donkey Kong Country style.
Sure, they were that was in that era where they were trying to show, look what the DS can do.
It doesn't look nearly as good. Yeah. And it looks like they just added more crap in it. Like there seems to be like now you have to grab the Kong letters like in the Country games. I would need to learn more about the game before I pulled the trigger on it.
So I will say Bubbles, which is the main character in Clue Clue Land, unlockable in your game, Guillaume.
What?
In
awesome.
In the GBA game?
Yeah.
That is awesome. That makes me want to buy this.
She reappears really again as the last secret character of the Game Boy Advance game, DK King of Swing,
Holy
which was inspired
cow.
By, if not somewhat a remake of, Clue Clue Land.
That is fantastic.
Wow. Oh, so man. What do you have to do? Like, do you have to go through all these time trial challenges? Because that would...
Probably something like that.
I would probably go insane. Like, I can't
yes,
do it.
That's exactly
sorry.
What you have to do.
Yes, get on it.
Asshole.
Actually, Guillaume, I have one more question about this game. I'm so glad you played this, because it definitely caught my eye for the same reason on that press release, the Nintendo download, the same reason that you were interested in it, because I never played it. And I mean, I probably played it at E3 for 5 minutes, but I never played it for real. And and I kind of always wanted to, and I thought, you know, now that it's, what, $8? Is that what they cost? $8? $6?
$7 or $8. I don't know.
Okay. Yeah. Something like, I mean, that seems like a price where even if I hate it, I won't feel that bad and I probably won't hate it. But, since the game is played only with the shoulder buttons on the GBA, it seems like just the physical experience of playing this would be so different on a Wii U control. I mean, are you using the gamepad? Are you using a pro controller? I mean, all these have such different shoulder buttons from each other.
Yeah, I have been wondering, like, would I enjoy this more if I were playing it in the GBA? But really, I've been playing it on a pro controller on the gamepad. It doesn't bother me as much as it bothers some people, I think. I'm looking at screenshots of the sequel now, and I think maybe I would have to buy it because instead of generic climbing walls, you've got like corn on the cob. You're climbing corn on the cob. Yeah,
that sounds pretty good.
Yeah, I don't know. It does look a
little bit hungry.
Does he eat it as he flies across it? Is he eating the corn?
Bananas only. Final Destination.
the A and B buttons do something in the game, but it's kind of weird. It's, I don't know, like you collect bananas as you do in Donkey Kong Country games, and the bananas are basically a currency. When you spend 10 of them, you can regain one bit of health, like one heart, and you can press A to spend 20 bananas to become invincible for a short period of time. So it's kind of weird. It's a weird system, but sometimes you really feel grateful that you went back to, you know, a couple of levels earlier and stocked up on bananas because otherwise, I don't know, your brain would be all over the wall.
Yeah. Well, and while we're talking about controller configuration, it's probably worth reminding people that on the Wii U Virtual Console, you can remap the buttons to whatever you want. Mm-hmm. So if you don't think that playing a game entirely with the L and R shoulder triggers sounds comfortable, then change it. You could play it with Y and X if you want to.
Right. So, that's easy. With like the pinball configuration, like the D-pad and the A button.
Oh, that's interesting. I still think I would probably want to put it on the ZL and ZR.
I think that's part of the experience.
Yeah.
But by default, I think it would be on the actual L and R, which especially on the gamepad, those are not very good buttons.
No, but I mean, you really just want to make sure that it registers your button presses. And I think they'll probably do okay for that.
I managed to get through the game without changing the controls, so.
Interesting. Okay. Well, that's good to know. But it sounds like you don't strongly recommend it.
It's, well, as I said, like, I don't know what's missing, I found it more frustrating than fun. And I liked Yumi's Odd Odyssey. So what's wrong with me? I don't know.
That one, Yumi will not be on my top five this year. I can say. Although I like it. I'm kind of between you and James on it. I mean, I think it's endearingly horrible and kind of like fun in how broken and impossible it is. But I don't actually like it. Anyway, okay. Well, King of Swing. Thanks.
But man, fuck those guys. Fuck you, Yumi.
Okay. Well, John, why don't you tell us what you've been playing?
Well, out of curiosity, Johnny actually suggested to me Tyrion 2000.
Which, I know you're always on the lookout for hot new games.
I am.
By the way, that game did not come out in 2000. That game came out when putting 2000 at the ends of thing made it sound futuristic.
Yes, that's correct. So this is what, from 1999, I believe, is actually when it came out. 1995, wow. I got it off of Good Old Game, so I think maybe the repackages. I don't even know. There's
a couple different versions of this game.
Yeah. So anyways, it's mid-90s. To say the least, it looks it. It's actually a pretty good looking game. It's a vertically scrolling shooter. And it's pretty cool. It's actually Tyrion, Luca Tyrion, who always calls in to our longtime fan of the show. Always calls in every year on our telethon. Is a huge fan of this game. So I'm glad that Johnny recommended, because I remember during the telethon, I actually wanted to check this out, but I didn't get around to it. So I'm actually glad Johnny suggested it.
I still want to check it out. I just haven't had a chance, but it's free. You can get it for free.
Yeah, it's, it's free on Good Old Games. So, and I guess it was made freeware in like 2004. So it's been freeware for a while.
That's
so
awesome.
Yep. Yeah. So it's a cool little game. You know, you control it with the mouse and your two mouse buttons. You know, the left mouse button is just for your normal trigger shooting, your normal front facing gun, and then you also have missiles or like secondary kind of, you know, bombs that you can shoot with your right mouse trigger. And it's cool because it usually layers on a little bit more plot than most shooters.
Especially shooters of that era.
Yeah. Shooters of this era were very, very, kind of like almost NES-style shooters. And apparently, according to the Wikipedia article for this thing, it was kind of an homage to the works of Compile, who made, for the NES, they made Zanac. So it's pretty cool. I mean, you can upgrade your ship. And there's really no penalty to you get credits that you kind of collect as you shoot enemies throughout the different areas. You can upgrade your ship in several different ways. You can change your front gun, your rear gun. You can buy like the kind of options, R-type style. I always call them options, but like missiles that shoot out and kind of follow stuff around the screen and stuff like that. That's the whole thing. And the thing is, there's no real penalty. Like, you can kind of change your build. It's, you can, even though you're spending these points, you can dial stuff back, dial it forward sort of thing. So you can, switch around stuff. It's pretty cool. So it has a lot of flexibility there in how you can outfit your ship. And, you can kind of go from planet to planet. And, along the way, you'll get these messages from various people that advance the plot. So there's a lot more around it than just like your typical sort of NES shooter that, I mean, they used to be completely arcade.
This would have not run on a Super Nintendo, probably. I mean, visually, there is a lot going on in this game.
Yeah, visually, yeah, it looks really good. The funniest thing, though, I have to say, is if you go into the options and you choose the game speed, I had to laugh because it goes from like slower to slow to normal to fast, and the highest one is Pentium, which is hysterical. It's like, so anybody running that high tech Pentium CPU back in '95, they were able to put this on quality visuals.
The '99 remake of this game, which is the version that you're playing, and I say remake, it's really just they've tacked on some extra content.
Yeah.
This was an old DOS shareware game, so Epic Mega Games, now known as Epic, makers of Gears of War.
Hell yeah.
They released this as kind of like one of those floppy disk shareware games you could like buy in a store for like a dollar.
That's how they really got started, though. They were doing, what was it?
Oh, yeah.
Commander Keen, I think, was
Jazz
one of those.
Jazz Jackrabbit, right?
Yeah, Jazz Jackrabbit, mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then so there was also, there was a, and this wouldn't have been Epic, but there was a 2D version of Wolfenstein before Wolfenstein 3D. That was a 2D, like Contra style, like run and gun platform shooter. That's really fun. I used to play it in typing class in middle school.
Nice.
Yeah.
So my history with this game actually is having acquired it as shareware and then having purchased the game through mail order, which is how you bought these games back when it was new. Well, this version of it was new. I just remember thinking, like, holy shit, this game is kind of visually ridiculous. Because we'd already reached a point where 2D shooters had kind of fallen out of favor. You had things like Descent being made. Microsoft had the Fury line, so Fury 3, Hellbender, and I can't remember the other one. And those were 3D. You moved in 3D space. You used 3D models. And they were just kind of clunky and slow. The Microsoft ones, they were fast, but they were just fast to say, look how fast we can make us go, whoa!
Yeah.
You couldn't actually do anything with it. But this game was fast in a different way. It was a 2D scrolling shooter that there was just shit on screen all the time. And to John's point, it's incredibly cartoony. Mm-hmm. The game becomes incredibly up its own ass at some points in the most wonderful ways. There's a bonus when you finish one of the chapters. There's this religious cult that uses ale, and their ale got stolen, so you have to chase it down. And when you shoot the ships that stole the ale, big things of ale come out as your bonus collecting.
When you say ale, you don't mean the letter. You mean like A-L-E, like beer?
Yes, as in like steins of beer.
Oh, weird.
Like that's your pickup in that one. It's called Zingon's Ale or something like that. There's one that makes a joke about Jazz the Jackrabbit. It's like there's this pilot. Nice. He's a rabbit. His ship's a carrot. And if you clear it, you get to buy the carrot ship. So your ship becomes a carrot. And the carrot ship is super overpowered. So like when I replayed the game over and over again, I invariably had a carrot ship.
Yeah.
Because it's way too powerful. The one thing about the builds in this game that I really like, though, and it sort of makes you think about it, is you can buy the base weapon and you can spend a lot of money upgrading them, but you have to be somewhat judicious with how you do it, because you also have to use a generator to have enough power to power the shields and the weapon systems. And you can fuck that up, especially early in the game, you don't have any money, and find yourself more or less just screwed because your generator is completely tapped out.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of managing this kind of stuff. Some weapons have ammo, some use just energy. It's surprisingly deep for what it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it when I play it, I can't help but wonder why somebody hasn't done something like this. And I mean, I feel like you could push this concept really, really far nowadays, but it just seems like every single 2D shooter that comes out, or you know, any shooter of this type that comes out, is generally pretty simplistic.
They're mostly bullet hells at this point.
There is that game Jamestown. I don't know if you guys ever tried that.
No.
It's a PC game. It's also a vertical shoot 'em up. But I believe there's a version of that coming to the PlayStation family, which makes me wonder if it might have a chance at least of also being an eShop game at some point in the future. But I played it on PC and I thought it was really great. And, it also has this kind of like 90s vibe, you know, kind of 16-bit look to it, although the artwork is really good, and it has like a huge upgrade tree, and it has a weird story that it tells, and it's super short. Is Tyrion 2000, is this also like really, you know, those shoot 'em ups are famous for being like really short.
It's got a pretty good number of levels.
Yeah.
I mean, I would guess there's two stories, or two chapters, I guess is what they call them. 15 to 20 stages each, and you can and in each stage there are hidden bonus stages, and in some bonus stages there are hidden bonus stages.
Yeah.
Yes. Oh, wow.
Yeah, so, I mean, you'll just be flying through and it's like secret level, and it's like you're like, what? And you'll go off to some crazy weird area.
Yeah, just complete bullshit. And some of those you can make. There's a secret level. There's two secret levels in the first stage, and if you get the second one, which is harder to find, you have to not unlock the first one. There's a secret level in that stage, and I think there's another one in that secret level, meaning you can go three deep and make a shit ton of money.
I gotta say, when Tyrion, the listener, talked about Tyrion the game and was describing it, I got really excited because it reminded me of this game I watched my brother play on the 10D1000, which is like kind of a, you know, Commodore 64, I guess, level of computer power. But it was like this vertical shooter in space where you would upgrade your weapons through a menu. And one of the upgrades was like lasers. Like you could upgrade the left and the right weapons independently.
Yep.
And nice. You could get stuck at some point if you took two lasers because one boss had like floating mirrors around it. And it would just reflect all your shots.
Yeah, it's something else, but that would be really evil.
Yeah. So I could never find again the name of the title of that game. So if anyone knows, please send an email.
Come to our rescue.
Interestingly enough, apparently, just reading the Wikipedia article, there was actually a Game Boy Color and a Game Boy Advance version.
There indeed was a Game Boy Advance.
But it was canceled.
Yep, I think I've seen a ROM of the Game Boy Advance version. I can't imagine the Game Boy Color version playing like anything other than ass.
Yeah.
For GBA, that GBA was the first widescreen Nintendo portable, and this is a vertical shoot-em-up, so it seems like you would want maybe to play it in Tate mode, or what, you know, where you rotate the system and kind of hold it funky.
But I mean, it was made for play on 4:3 monitors, so it kind of handles it, because your ship is very small.
Mm-hmm.
In the grand scheme of things.
Yeah, and it has sort of the HUD is on the right-hand side, so it is very vertical anyways. Yeah. It kind of turns it into that. It turns it into a more
there's
vertical
Tate mode. I can't imagine the GBA would have handled it very well either. I know that there is people have made versions of this game that run on other stuff. So I think I want to say there's a version you can run on a homebrewed Wii console.
Yeah, apparently there
is. Just for shits, I guess.
Yep.
Is it? This
well,
is
I gotta try that.
So is this game freeware now, or is it open source?
It's freeware. I believe the open source version of it is what some people rebuilt the game.
Yeah. Oh, okay. It's called OpenTyrion.
Oh, of course.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's cool.
It's apparently, yeah, they some guys rewrote the Pascal source code.
Oh my god.
That's pretty awesomely old school right there. The Pascal source code was rewritten in C for OpenTyrion and licensed under the GNU General Public License.
I was hoping you were going to say the Pascal source code was rewritten in Fortran, because then I might even be able to hack in there and do something with it, but I don't know C or Pascal.
Yeah. Well, that sounds great, man.
I'm definitely excited to play it for myself, and I have downloaded it, but I haven't played it yet. And I think I'm going to wait till I get home because I don't want to try playing this with a touchpad.
No,
I mean I seem to recall playing it growing up with the keypad and the spacebar as my primary weapons buttons.
Yeah,
that sounds a lot better than the touchpad.
Yeah,
you know, I'm pretty sure that's how I played it, and I mean I've played this game probably 1,000 times, so it's. I like this game a lot growing up.
Yeah,
it's good. It definitely stands the test of time.
Very nice. All right. Well, I will wrap up new business with a couple of games. First off, I want to follow up from last week's comments on Zeo Drifter, which has been out for a week now. I beat it the next day. So it took me 2 days of, you know, sometimes intense playing. I don't know how many hours overall. I would say maybe 3 or 4. And I enjoyed it quite a bit. There were times that it really frustrated me, and that I was in one of those when I talked about it last week. So I probably came off as pretty negative. But I think there was one other time later on where I got not stuck, but I got into kind of a hole where it was very hard for me to get back to my ship. And this game, it has a tendency to do that because there are no checkpoints. There are no save rooms in Zeo Drifter. So it is much more like the original Metroid, I guess you would say. But even that game had a password system. So if you beat a boss or if you got a power up and you died, you'd get a password and then you could restart, and it would put you at the beginning of the game when you used a password, but you would still have that upgrade. You would have the key or whatever you had. Whatever you got before you died. And in Zeo Drifter, it uses it obviously has a save point system, but you can only save in your ship. And there's 4 different planets. So you can save between planets, but you can never save, on a planet except at a boss room. And then it automatically saves as a checkpoint when you get to a boss or when you finish a boss. But the problem is sometimes they will put really long, really, really tough passages from, let's say, between a boss and getting back to your ship to go to a different planet to use whatever power you got from that boss to get to a new place. And just returning to your ship often is the biggest challenge in the game. And a lot of it comes down to the fact that, I mean, this game, it really has about as much in common with Mutant Muds as it does Metroid. And those two games have a few, you know, mechanics in common anyway. It's a lot of jumping and shooting and sometimes hovering. But in Zeo Drifter, there's no hovering. You're just you're jumping and shooting. You can flip it back and forth between the foreground and the background once you get a certain upgrade. And then there's some fun mobility stuff. You can do like a super jump, and you can run really fast. But those are kind of very specific situations that you would use those. Most of the time, you're just jumping and shooting. And that part of it is pretty straightforward. It's pretty simple. The feel of it is very similar to Mutant Muds. And I think if you absolutely love Mutant Muds and you just played it to death, and then it came out on Wii U and it had extra levels, and you played it again on that system or on PC, then you should buy this. I mean, if you love Mutant Muds, I think you should buy Zeo Drifter, because it is in many ways kind of like a mirror universe version of Mutant Muds. I mean, it's very, very similar action. It's shorter, but it brings in the exploration aspect and the upgrade system, which Mutant Muds doesn't really have much of. So You know, in that sense, I can highly recommend it. I think it's a very polished, well-made game. It is definitely short. I mean, even for a Metroid-style game, it's short. So, you know, it's also only $10. So for me, that's okay. I mean, there aren't that many of this kind of game that get made. And there's certainly a lot of design put into it because you have these somewhat non-linear maps. Now, I'll say the paths that you go on through these worlds tend to be pretty linear. You know, it's like long hallways, long vertical shafts. There may occasionally be like an alternate path you can take if you have a certain power. And there are certainly like little spurs off of the main path where you can find extra hit points or, you know, something like that. But, or extra, there's a neat little gun customization thing where you find these points. It's one of the collectibles in the game. You find these gun points, on the map, and you, on the touchscreen of the game, you have this elaborate system where you can assign, these gun points to different aspects of your gun to change how it behaves. So you can give yourself a wave beam, for instance, and the more points you put on that, the wider the wave is that the shot undulates back and forth. So that makes it easier to hit enemies because you don't have to aim as closely, because if, you know, there's more than likely it'll move, up and down enough that you'll hit it. You can also make your shots go faster. You can make your shots bigger and more powerful. You can make it so that you can, fire more shots per second or have more shots on the screen before you have to wait to shoot again. And so you can really choose how you want your weapon to behave. And as you explore more and you find more of these gun points, it lets you combine all these different characteristics, or you can focus on one or two and really fill them out and max them out. Which I think is a really cool way to handle weapon upgrades. I mean, because they're, you know, at the end of the game, your preference or the way that you have kitted out your gun might be totally different than someone else's. None of this is explained though in the game. And in fact, it's all even like visual on the touchscreen. So you don't even necessarily know what these different things do until you try them. And I do like that you can reconfigure that stuff anytime you want. So you don't have to commit to anything. You can say, well, what if I put all these, I don't know what the symbol means, but what if I put all my points under there? How does it affect my gun? And it's very easy to test those things out and to play around with it. But it's interesting because I think some of those characteristics are much more important than others. They're much more useful. And I guess really you just kind of have to try it for yourself to figure it out. But for me, I found that there were certain ones that seemed kind of useless and certain ones that seemed extremely useful. But maybe that's just my preference. I don't know. The other thing about Zeo Drifter is, and I know Neil Ronahan has pointed this out a lot, and he's right to do so. It has exactly one boss that you fight six or seven times.
Good.
Throughout the game. So it's kind of the EAD Tokyo problem, but worse.
Hey. They usually have like four.
Yeah, they usually have four that they use two or three times each. So this is even worse. Now, you could also argue, well, at least they did a boss, because like Mutant Muds doesn't have bosses, and it's kind of a notable lacking in that game. It feels weird that a game in that style. I mean, Mutant Muds is in a lot of ways just Mega Man, but Mega Man without
whoa.
No, it is.
No.
Yeah, sure,
no.
It is.
Is a bad Mega Man.
Oh, I disagree, but I mean, it is very similar. It is much in the template of Mega Man, but it has no bosses, and it's like, wait, what? I mean, the levels are really interesting, but still, you get to the end, and it's just the end, and it feels really weird. Even at the end of the game, you know, like the final level is just the final level, and you get to the end, and hey, you beat the game. I mean, there's no big climax to it, really. Zeo Drifter, I mean, it does at least have a boss. In fact, a huge chunk of the time that you're playing this game will be spent on that boss, because it takes so much longer to beat the boss than it does to actually get through most of the levels. And the boss evolves. Every time you fight the boss, it gets stronger, and it adds new waves of attacks. It adds different types of attacks. It makes you use your abilities that you've picked up along the way. And you know, I mean, it's by the end, it's very complex. It takes a very long time to kill. And it is making you use almost every ability that you found up to that point. And it's a very interesting boss battle, but it feels like they designed one interesting boss battle and then said, okay, we need to stretch this out over the whole game because we don't have time to do other bosses. So let's just peel off more and more and more abilities and make it easier and easier until we kind of find a version that can be the first time you meet him. And we'll put that at the beginning of the game. You know what I mean? I mean, it's like the final version of it is a really good, challenging, interesting boss. The first two or three or four versions of it aren't that interesting. And especially the problem with the final version is by the time you get to it, you can't even appreciate how cool of a boss it is because you've already seen 90% of what it has going on. And you kind of already know how to deal with all that. So it becomes just kind of a slog to get through it. I mean, that boss took me the time that I beat it, I think it probably took me about 10 or 15 minutes to beat. And this is in a very fast-paced action game. So it's not that great. You know, it's definitely a problem with the game. And I'll say that there are a lot of secrets. So if you're the kind of person who likes to explore 2D platforming type games and look for a lot of secrets, I think you'll be happy with Zeo Drifter because there are quite a few and they're like extra hit points, extra gun points. I mean, they're not a huge deal, but they definitely make the game a little bit easier and you can feel the difference when you find that stuff. But the way the secret rooms and the secret passageways are implemented, I don't think is all that great. I don't think it really lives up to the Metroid legacy because maybe it is more like the original Metroid where it feels like you kind of just have to like hug every single wall and just see which ones you can go through. There's no clue in the artwork. There's no X-ray scope. There's not even bombs in this game, you know, and so it could be literally any wall in the entire game could be a secret passage. And the only way you'll ever find them is just to rub up against every single wall in the game. And it's like, that's not fun.
That's not what people want to do,
you know?
It's like that thing. It's
fucking
Mylon
Secret Castle shit. What are you doing?
Well, that's the thing. It's like, you know, it's that was fine back in like 1987.
No, it wasn't. No, it wasn't. It wasn't fine then. It's not fine now.
It was fine back then because nobody knew any better. Like there was nobody else that solved that problem, right?
I mean, I think it is intentionally retro. I feel like we can do better in 2014 than that. I mean, I love that
in 2034 we're going to be making 3D platformers with cameras that have no fucking clue where to look? just because you're making it intentionally retro doesn't make it a good idea.
Yeah. Exactly.
Well, and I mean, it's a good idea to put secret rooms in this game, and they're fun. They're fun when you find them. But I'm glad that there are so many. But yeah, there just doesn't seem to be a lot of methodology in where those rooms are placed or how to find them. It feels most of the time I found them, it felt like an accident. And that's not really how you want a game like this to be designed, you know? So
I think,
it's a bit of a disappointment, but I'll say the main journey through the main content, I found satisfying and fun, and it is definitely challenging. I mean, it is a really surprisingly tough game. Maybe it shouldn't be a surprise if you played Mutant Muds, but Mutant Muds came out like, 3 years ago or something like that? So I might have forgotten just how difficult it can be, but Zeo Drifter is a difficult game. But it's a really good one. It's nicely polished and I'm glad it's out there. I would love, kind of like Mutant Muds, I would love to see them do another one of these and kind of refine it and add more to it and, you know, take another crack at some of these ideas that they have. And maybe that'll happen at some point. But the first one is worth playing. I did enjoy it. It's not like the greatest indie-developed Metroid-inspired game that I've played, but I think it's a pretty good one. And it's worth checking out for sure. The other game that I've been playing this week, although not much yet, because I just got it a couple days ago and I've been so busy, but I did finally download Captain Toad, Treasure Tracker. And a lot of people have been asking, why haven't we talked about this game on the show? And it's like, well, none of us have it. I mean, we want it. Some of us want it. We can't get it yet. But again, with the eShop cards being on sale, I figured I might as well just go ahead and get this. And it seemed, I jumped into that before Bayonetta because I figured I could get more of a sense of Captain Toad in a small amount of time. And yeah, I mean, from the first, you know, couple hours of playing Captain Toad, I would say it is exactly what you think it is.
Right. It's those levels from 3D World.
It is those. Yes. It is more of those. They add a couple extra, you know, I mean, I don't think you could pull up plants out of the ground in 3D World.
No.
And they didn't have the, you know, the minecarts show up every 10 or 15 levels. And those are, they're neat. You know, they definitely feel like Pokemon Snap, but they're also, they're over so fast. I mean, all the levels in this game
are small.
Yeah,
there was a demo for the minecart at E3, and it was like 25 seconds long. Like, good job! And I'm like, oh.
That's representative from what I've seen.
Okay.
I mean, because those minecart levels are about the same scale as all the other levels, except you're on a minecart, so you just race through it way faster. Because Toad runs really slow. Toad and Toadette, they play the same. And I'm in the Toadette part of the game now, and she's absolutely the same thing. I mean, I guess she has different sound effects. But I think one issue I kind of have with the game is I don't think it's that much fun to control, because the characters, they do move so slowly, and they don't really do anything but walk around. You know, like they just don't, there's not many moves that they have. And so it never feels like you have a lot of control over the character. They're so limited. The camera control is odd. I remembered it being a little more fluid in 3D World, but that could just be my memory playing tricks on me. But in this game, it seems like you can spin it in any direction, but you can only spin it around, like left to right or up and down, but not both at the same time.
Oh, really?
Does that make sense? So it doesn't have this, it feels, it's not in notches like you have in 3D World. You know, you could move the camera, but only like, you know, 10 degrees and then another 10 degrees or whatever. I mean, in Captain Toad, it's more fluid than that. You can spin it, but you can't spin it diagonally. And a lot of times the angle that I want in this game to look at, I end up having to move it, like spin it to the right and then spin it up. And it feels like I should just be able to do it up and to the right, but the game won't let me do that. You have to do one and then the other. So it feels like it actually takes a little bit too long to do some of this stuff. It's very strange. And you definitely...
Yeah, like it feels like something that they should patch. I mean...
Yeah.
I don't know.
Maybe the engine can't, or the frame rate can't handle moving in multiple axes at the same time, but I don't know why that would make a difference. The game is fun. I mean, it's very cute. It's very simple. The levels are all very short. You know, even as slow as Toad and Toadette are and, you know, the fact that they can't jump, it makes you sometimes take these torturous paths to get to certain parts of the level, you know, because you have to kind of climb up and then fall down on a different place that you couldn't get to before. And then you walk over here and then something falls out from under you. And now you have to go around through this tunnel. You know, I mean, there's a lot of thought put into the paths that you take through this game, but there are paths. And this is something that I think you have to appreciate that's so different about Captain Toad versus a 3D Mario game. Because in 3D Mario game, they set up these environments and there are different ways to approach a lot of times. You can also play with the physics in Mario games a lot and maybe get, you know, shortcut around something. Or you can just kind of blast through something and avoid, you know, just skip enemies sometimes if you're really fast and bold. But in Captain Toad, because his moves are so restricted, it feels like these levels just kind of have like, there's a pathway. I mean, there's almost like a script you could write that would just make Toad go through this. So.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. Like the game is not a platformer. It's really a puzzle game, right?
It's more like a maze game. I would say.
Right.
It's a 3D maze.
Well, you know, like you say that Captain Toad is slow and not much fun to move around. It's kind of similar to something like Adventures of Lotto. You know, like the fun of the game is figuring out how to get from point A to point B or to collect all these things and not so much moving around. You're not getting the feeling of, you know, that you get from moving Mario around.
Yeah, that's a fair comparison. And also, you know, just like in Lolo, it's about how to avoid the enemies or on occasion how to dispatch the enemies using whatever means you have available. So you can throw vegetables, you can find a pickaxe sometimes that makes you go into hyper mode and then you can run around and just kill everything. But those are very rare. Right. And, or you can drop from above, which is, that's very satisfying if you can pull it off. If you drop from a ledge up above onto an enemy's head, even like a charging chuck, which they brought back from Super Mario World, those are in this game, and you can drop on top of those and kill them. So, you know, Toad is so feeble that when he defeats like a big, you know, football dude, Japanese football player, who, you know, may or may not be throwing around a baseball also, it makes you feel good. It's like, whoa, I can't believe I just killed that enemy. You know, that's something Mario would do, but Toad is not really supposed to be able to do that. But sometimes you can kind of trick it.
Do you have already unlocked, like, is it from as soon as you start the game, do you get these like supplemental challenges in each level, like climb ladders like 3 times at most and stuff like that?
Yeah. Well, you can't see those challenges until you finish the level. So sometimes you might accidentally, or maybe you're just paying really close attention the first time you play it and you find the golden mushroom, or you decide, well, I've already killed most of the enemies. I'm going to see if I can find a way to kill the rest of the enemies. And sometimes you do these things, or you just get a lot of coins. Sometimes it's just, hey, get a bunch of coins. And maybe you do that your first playthrough because that's how you roll. And if you pull that off, then it will give you credit for doing the bonus objective, but it won't actually tell you what it is until afterward. TIE Fighter used to do this too. It drove me crazy. So you have to basically, you have to finish the level in whatever capacity, and then it will tell you what the objective is. And then you probably have to go back and play the level at least 2 times in order to get everything. It is possible to do it on the first playthrough though. It certainly is.
Right.
I've done it once or twice.
So you were saying like there was one way to go through a level, and that's kind of the, you know, some of the challenges that I've seen are revolving around like going through the level optimally.
Yes, a lot of them focus on playing extremely efficiently.
Right, like the climb 3 ladders thing. Like at first you're like, how do I do that? Like I can't possibly avoid this enemy if I don't climb up here. And then you figure it out, and it's just like another puzzle on top of the puzzle that is the level.
Right.
Yeah.
So I don't know how much I'm going to enjoy going back through the levels and just trying to do all the bonus things. I do think finding all the diamonds will be fine. Because I'm finding most of them. I'm not necessarily getting all 3 of the diamonds before I move on to the next level. I typically don't play that way, in that kind of completionist way. I want to play through all of it, and then I'll start over and I'll play through the game a second time if I have to, just to find all those secret things. I mean, to me, that's a good excuse to go back and revisit that stuff. And also, that gives you a way to kind of compare what you've seen at the end of the game versus what was back at the beginning that you might have forgotten. And it's kind of neat to see the progression when you do that. So that's my preferred style of going through these Nintendo games, where they have all these optional objectives. But the diamonds are, to me, are the fun part, because they're hidden so well sometimes. I mean, a lot of times they're out in the open. You just have no idea how to get to it. And then in a lot of cases, they're hidden, and you have to do certain things. Maybe you have to kill a certain enemy, or there's a secret passage that you have to find. And they're pretty good about putting little windows in the outside of the level. So if you just spin the camera around, you can look at a place that you don't know how to get to it, but you can see that there's a diamond over there. And now you can kind of focus on, wait, how do I get from where I am to where that thing is? Well, I have to bust through the floor here, and then I have to, you know, look for a secret passage when I'm going through the underground section. I mean, there's lots of different ways that they handle that. But I think in general, they tend to put them in plain sight, or at least they put them where they're visible when you spin the camera. And the question is, how in the world am I supposed to get over there? And that's fun. In a game like this, that's really where a lot of the fun comes in. So I'm enjoying it quite a bit so far. Again, there's really nothing surprising about it. I mean, I feel like most people already know exactly what Captain Toad is, and when you play the game, it does what it says on the box. I mean, there's really nothing very surprising about it, but it seems well made, and I think what it has going over something like 3D World is that, number one, there's no timer, so the game has a much more relaxed, leisurely kind of feel to it. Even though, you know, there are enemies that will chase you. So there are moments when you might feel kind of stressed out and hurried, But most of the time, you can just kind of stand anywhere and look around as long, and you need to. I mean, you need to look around. You need to spin that camera, and you need to kind of figure out where you're going and where everything is. And I like that the game sort of allows you to do that. And then the other thing is the levels are so small and so short that you can play through them in less than 5 minutes. I mean, probably every single one of them can be beaten in less than 5 minutes. And so it has this kind of, it feels more like a portable game in a lot of ways. And I'm playing it on the gamepad. So for me, it kind of is, here in the hotel. But it has the kind of pace and the drip of small bite-sized content that a portable game would. And it makes me wonder if maybe on the new 3DS, since it has two joysticks, it seems like a new Captain Toad game or maybe a port of this one would make a lot of sense on that platform. So I'm curious to see whether they bite on that opportunity. But it's pretty fun so far. I like it. It's nothing like mind-blowing, but it's fun, and it's basically what I wanted. It's what I expected.
Cool.
All right, guys. Well, that is going to wrap up new business. I'm sure we'll have lots more thoughts on, stuff like Bayonetta 2 and Captain Toad in the future, after the holidays especially. But for right now, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll have your listener mail.
It's Now Playing, a sampling of the best new original content at NintendoWorldReport.com. First up this week, we have a review revisit, which I presume is when we go back and read a review we've already had, like revisiting it like it's family.
Yes, it's kind of a holiday theme.
Oh, okay, I see. So this is your pilgrimage home to review revisit of Super Mario 3D Land for the 3DS, which is a game that came out like 15 years ago.
Yep, about.
On the 3DS. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, this team has made two games, a game and a half since this game came out. I'm looking at you, Toad. But Alex, JP, John, and Curtis, a lot of people, sit down and rescore one of Mario's finest handheld outings. Well, wait, doesn't that kind of spoil it, John? I mean, if they're going to rescore it, but we're going... Why don't you say rescore one of Mario's most ambiguous qualities handheld outings? Because doesn't that make the reader... Our job here, John, is to make the reader go to the website.
I think it's widely considered one of his finest outings. But that's the thing, though. There may be a swerve here.
Oh, really?
Yeah, why don't you continue?
Neil also gives his two cents, a commentary that, in this man's opinion, equates to a 7.5 out of 10.
Indeed.
I think there's some score inflation there.
There might be.
I'm aware of what I just said, Neil. Deal with it. We also have a review of 99 Moves, I'm Getting Fired, for Wii U by Don Koopman. Don continues his quest to review every impossibly obscure title on the Wii U, which is to say every title on the Wii U.
Yeah.
Titles like Smash Brothers be damned. 99 Moves is where it's at. It's like Bumpers Only on a stage created by me.
Indeed. Amen.
And if you want the pure, the real... This is it right here. And by it, John's script means cocaine.
Of course, I thought that was just assumed.
Yeah, well, I gotta make it... Some people here don't have the street sense.
It's okay. It's like, not everybody can have the head cold. Some people have, like, head coal, head, like, you know...
Head colds, I mean...
Yeah, it's...
I've had those before. They're not fun. And cocaine clears them right up.
Yep.
Nose is just...
Yep.
Free and clear like a summer bird.
Things get done on cocaine. You heard it right here.
Things get done very fast on cocaine.
They do.
Not like this segment.
Nope. All right. And also, we have a review of Tested with Robots on Wii U by Don Koopman. What was that we just said about impossibly obscure titles? Oh, I meant impossibly awful titles.
Don. Please.
Yeah, Don.
I'm worried about you.
I know. I'm worried too. I'm worried for Don. I hope Don had a shower after this one and read his review to find out why. Actually, probably don't. This game looks like it was made on the Atari 2600.
Maybe. Wait. for or on? Was it programmed on a 2600?
I think somebody was actually standing on an Atari 2600 when they were programming this.
Programming it via an Amstrad CPC.
Yep, yep.
Oh my god. Yeah, this looks...
It's bad. It's...
I suggest reading it just so you can see. This is the man who wrote a small soliloquy about Sonic Boom on Wii U. Mm-hmm. This is worse.
Yeah, he actually says that in the review. He says, yeah, I played Sonic Boom, and I thought that was bad, but this is worse. So
I want to go ahead and say right now, for the people listening, you know, I have a degree related to science. I'm a member of professional organizations. This is not...
You're very important. You drive a Dodge
Stratus. No, I should just say this. This is not an unlicensed and unregulated psychological experiment on Mr. Koopman. We did not choose to do this.
Yeah.
This is not a clinical study or a non-clinical study. This isn't a study at all. Perhaps it should be. Perhaps we should be monitoring his well-being.
Yeah.
But he did this to himself.
At this point, I really have to wonder. I fear for Don's future. I'll openly say that.
I fear for the world's future. I mean, when you bottle this much up in one person, this many terrible experiences. Mm-hmm. I mean, mm-hmm. and you just
yeah. And I mean the two that we've had here in this little in this achingly glacially paced segment. I mean, these are only two experiences in the life of a man who has had many experiences like these.
Just in the last couple months,
like horrible games that no one should be subjected to.
When you bring them down into one place like this, you sort of get the big bang where it's all compressed into a point. Eventually, it's going to explode, mm-hmm. and we're going to be awash in Don's back waves of terrible experiences. And I'm not insured for that.
No, I mean...
That's not on the home insurance. Don, I need you to take a break.
Just
Don,
take a break.
Go play something not so bad.
Something less Sonic-y.
Something that Nintendo World Report would give around 7, like Mario Kart 8.
All right, moving on. We also have another review, because this is apparently the time for reviews. This is the review season.
Yeah, I mean, basically right after Christmas is when all your games should come out.
I'm opening up my Nintendo World Report stocking, and there's plenty of reviews in it. All right, we have a review of Battle Miner for 3DS by Addison Webb. Perhaps you've heard of a game called Minecraft. Again, pretty obscure.
I've only heard of Tales from Minecraft, the story mode.
Again, pretty obscure. Well, there's the game called Battle Miner that kills it. Oh, wait, that's a total lie, and Addison hates himself for playing it.
Don't worry, Addison. I can't fucking say it. I do wonder if the Wii... This is a 3DS game, dear God.
Yeah.
I do wonder if the respective eShops are now just toxic waste dumps.
They're pretty bad now, for the most part.
Hey, you could go buy Persona Q, or you could buy a game called fucking Battle Miner.
Yeah.
But Nintendo World Report will tell you, in case you couldn't figure it out on your own, it's not the place you should be looking for games.
No.
Remember, kids, use your Digitalux points to go buy Tested for Robots.
Yeah, you know, still don't know why Minecraft is not a Nintendo platform. Still baffles me when it's on every single other platform out there.
Well, now that Microsoft bought them, that's probably not happening.
I don't know. I mean, they're still going to keep it on everything, I think. I mean, it does them no good to break it off of all those other platforms.
I'm not sure what good buying Mojang did them to begin with.
I don't know either, but hey, you know.
This is all this and way better content than what we talked about here is available to you right now. We have reviews, previews, news, impressions. Sometimes I have to go and remind you what the segment's about, because we forget too. The segment's about telling you where you can get all your Nintendo features, your Nintendo news.
Mm-hmm.
Game of the Year is coming. We don't even do a Game of the Year, but we're having one.
We don't even have a year.
Yeah, we're on a fiscal calendar.
I mean, I threw out my Julian calendar. I tossed it.
Yeah.
I don't even follow it.
Lunar months only, you know? In the Nintendo World Report.
I mean, time may actually cease to be a concept in my world.
Well, I think it has this segment.
I mean, it's...
But what I'm telling you, what I am telling
Preach.
You, is that if you have a hankering to read about Nintendo, to see videos about Nintendo, to communicate with people who love Nintendo more than they love their own well-being, people who will fight and die
Preach.
For a villager amiibo.
Preach.
People for whom this is their existence.
Preach.
There's only one place you should be going. one place. And that place is NintendoWorldReport.com.
Amen.
Welcome back to the show, everybody. It is time for listener mail, and as always, the address is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com, and James is going to read the first email.
Tripon writes, I've been fortunately strong enough to avoid buying amiibos.
Smart man.
Because I know if I buy one, I will try to buy them all. John, we talked about this last week. We did. However, there's been reports of shortages of certain figures, of factory defects selling for thousands of dollars on eBay, retailer exclusivity, people camping, calling retailers to find out if they have uncommon and rare amiibos. And pre-orders for the second and third wave are already selling out. We know that the Smash amiibos have been a success for Nintendo, since the recent Nintendo PR release for the NPD said that amiibo figures have sold roughly the same amount as Smash Wii U copies. So, thoughts?
Don't buy amiibos.
Wait. Give that a moment for my performance.
Amiibo suck.
Okay.
It was dramatic.
Yeah. Very, very good. Very good.
So, John, what do you think about amiibos?
John, I think what we said about amiibos got covered last week.
I am amiiboed out. I'm burned out. I'm tired of people freaking out about them on Twitter, seeing, oh, Villager amiibo in stock at Toys R Us. Rush, go get it, or else your children will go hungry.
It's really tempting every single day to not just go on Twitter and go, hey, I saw Villagers at Target. Like, it's really hard, and every person that follows me should be very thankful that I haven't done it, because it's really difficult.
Well, if it's real that Tripon doesn't want to buy one, otherwise he's going to want to buy them all, then I say don't buy one.
Yeah, I say buy one, and no. Then just put it facing you at all times, and just go, you don't have power over me.
Exposure therapy, I think it's called, right?
Yeah.
If you buy them all, then they'll hold no power over you because you'll be
right.
Sick of them.
I won't need to get any more of these because I have all of these.
Yep.
Yeah, like the whole thing though, like if you want them because you hear that they're rare and because you hear that people are chasing them and going nuts, like that's just hype. That's not you wanting the thing.
Yeah. Man,
that's
I
you just wanting to live that hype.
You just want to be part of something larger than yourself.
Yep, you want the scarf, so to speak. You want the scarf.
No, but seriously, like if that's why you want to do it, then I say if you actually do it, then you're going to regret it. You know.
But see, here's the counter to that, which is maybe I don't know that I want to do it right now. But now I'm worried that if I don't do it now, I won't get the chance.
Yeah, you can't even be wishy-washy about amiibos because they're so scarce.
If I don't buy these toys right now, how do I know that, like, when I'm 50, I'm not going to want some toys?
Yeah.
You know,
there's going to be different toys.
John.
Or when I'm 60 that I won't want some toys like that.
Oh, my God. John,
I got there already, buddy.
Yeah.
Hey,
the Lego sets in the future are going to be so much better than the Lego sets right now. I'm telling you.
That's not true at all. Some of the most recent Lego sets are pure garbage. So no, that's not true.
I can hear in John's voice that he was intercepting James's joke. It was so
perfect.
Yeah, I saw where he was going.
Son of a bitch.
It's so perfect. You know, the sad thing to me about this whole thing, there's a lot of sadness to it. I mean, I feel bad for
We're
people.
So anti-amiibo. I love it.
There's a lot of sadness. Everybody just feels sad for the holidays.
I'm not anti-amiibo. I'm totally indifferent to amiibo. I don't give a shit about amiibo. Okay. I don't hate it. I'm not angry that it exists. I'm not angry that other people want them. I just don't care. It's not for me.
Sure.
But the sad thing is that it seems like there's probably an interesting conversation about how the amiibos are being used, especially in Smash, because it's all extremely trivial in the other games. But in Smash Brothers, it's not that appealing to me, but I think it's an interesting idea that you can create these custom AI characters who will fight against you or on your behalf or whatever, and they train and they come out with very different behaviors based on how you treat them and what you do to train them. And now I'm hearing about like amiibo only tournaments are going to be staged. Well, I think that's great. That's fascinating.
There was apparently a tournament in Vancouver where one of them actually almost won the tournament.
It's like a Pokemon tournament where you literally train your Pokemon and fight them against other people's Pokemon.
Oh, fuck! No, don't talk about Pokemon amiibo. Don't.
It's inevitable.
It's coming. Yeah.
That is. I mean, they're already.
The Surgeon General may stop that. Please, we just can't have this.
James, keep in mind there are amiibo who are Pokemon.
Yeah, but those aren't Pokemon amiibo. You know the fuck I'm talking about.
Yeah, it's already begun. Totally, James, just accept it.
I'd be surprised actually if they don't patch in amiibo support for Omega Red and Ruby Sapphire, or just make that like the centerpiece of next year's Pokemon.
I'm about to say no. That's the next one that's going to be. Oh no, fuck! That's going to be the new 3DS exclusive one that comes up. God damn it!
Well, what they're going to do too is they'll have ones like from Pokemon White and Pokemon Black. Like they'll have two separate sets of amiibos. Think about the possibilities.
John, I want you to go outside. Lean your head in the door frame and just slam the door.
Think about what you've done. But no, I mean, the sad thing to me is that people aren't talking about what you can do with amiibos and whether or not that's compelling or in what ways it is interesting and new and surprising and interesting. The only thing people are really talking about right now is how fucking hard it is to find it.
Well, maybe that was Nintendo's plan all along. Maybe they don't want you to stop and think.
Pause. Because I'm the cynic here, and I will not have you fucking stepping on my lines.
Yep.
I want you to go back to the E3 Nintendo Direct, where Sakurai explicitly tells you to not buy all the amiibos.
Oh, come on. That's reverse psychology. Come on.
He fucking says,
don't buy them, Nintendo fans. Don't buy them.
Nintendo literally told you in a thing targeting you to not buy all of these.
Hey, you people that will line up outside at 4 a.m. for a Nintendo scarf, don't buy these.
2 a.m., fuck you. And secondly, but I mean, my point is that I don't think they were trying to create an artificial scarcity, although
Nintendo never does that, ever.
Shut the fuck up, John.
I think they create a lot of accidental scarcity.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I think the scarcity of these things comes down to they fucked up. I think
right now, the reason we talk about this more than anything is that there's really only one game using them in any meaningful way. And, because, I mean, so Hyrule Warriors has them patched in, but it doesn't really do much.
So is this a botched rollout in that ultimately the rollout itself became more of a story than what you actually do with these things? I mean, to me, if they'd had five games lined up that all had really interesting uses of amiibos, number one, that would make it a much better product, much more appealing to most people, me included. And number two, people might actually be talking about that rather than, hey, they didn't make enough of them.
Well, I think that what James, like, are you trying to get at the fact that maybe, like, you want to be future-proof? Like, you want the amiibos now because, you know, when Animal Crossing shows up on the Wii U.
I was getting at that earlier, but now I'm talking about the fact that there's no narrative to push. If you're trying to write stories or you're trying to chat about shit on the internet or go into NeoGAF and post, and you know, threads with 57,000 GIFs in them.
You know I am.
Yeah, I know.
That's how I do.
I know. So what are you going to talk about? The fact that somebody has a level 97 Peach that I just can't fucking beat? Or that, God damn it, where am I going to find a villager? I mean, because the problem is, to your point, if there were five or six compelling uses for that Peach amiibo right now, then that could at least be part of the story. Now, the scarcity would still be part of the story because it is something that is affecting people on the internet who want to buy one of these things. They want to give Nintendo their money. And Nintendo has no real strong PR response for them.
No.
It's not – I mean, people seem mortified that they're making these things in series, but that's not really surprising because they have to have toy lines. They have to ship this shit from China. They're going to make them in series simply because they don't have – you can't have a factory making every single amiibo unless you want to spend a shit ton of cash. It seems just as likely they're just going to rotate through and produce lines. You know, all right, now our machine's making Duck Hunt. Yep. Well, now we're going to the Duck Hunt machine to the Peach machine. Now it's going back to be the Toon Link machine again.
Yep.
It's So the fact that that's all people really have to talk about has almost magnified this story, and in turn, it's probably driven some degree of panic buying.
Right, but Nintendo could be way more on the ball with their PR and say, you know these Marth amiibos that you can't find, if Fire Emblem Cross SMT comes out one day, we're going to make them again.
Like, but they probably just won't. They're probably going to make different amiibos then.
Exactly.
They could just say, well, you're not going to need it for that game.
Okay, but that's they probably don't know. They probably don't know what they're going to do with those amiibos. I guarantee you that the Marth amiibo for Smash Brothers will work on the next Fire Emblem game, but it's probably going to have other amiibos that are specific to that Fire Emblem game that also work.
These things aren't really about the games. I mean, let's just face
it. Not right now. I mean, they may be in the future, but at this point, there's I mean, Nintendo seems to be very consciously aware of the fact that they can't make these things physical-ass DLC. So what they're doing is anything that you can get out of them always seems to be constrained as kind of an extra thing, not really, you know, not content packs. So Disney Infinity garbage where it's like, oh, you want to do the stuff in the commercial? You got to spend $900 in fucking plastic figures.
Right, yeah. But I have to believe that Nintendo would not lock content behind like a rare amiibo in a future game and not give you another way to unlock it. Through paying for DLC or through another figure?
I don't think they would ever do it as paid DLC. I think that would send entirely the wrong message they're trying to send with amiibo.
It already is paid DLC.
Right, yeah, but they can't possibly expect people to buy a Marth amiibo just in case. And I don't think that they are because they're not selling them.
I don't think they are. I'm just saying that, yeah, if you have that Smash Brothers amiibo, it will probably do something in the next Fire Emblem game that maybe the other amiibos won't do. But what I'm saying is it's probably not going to be a big fucking deal. It's not going to be like, oh, you get the alternate portrait of Marth on his portrait screen. Okay, great.
Yeah, it's really, the problem is that the amiibo strategy has not been explained at all.
Well, I think they're probably still feeling it out.
Well, sure, they don't know exactly what they're going to do, but if they came out and said, you know what, if you didn't get the Marth this time and you really wanted one, don't worry, we're going to do a series, a volume two, he'll be in a different pose, so if you did get the first one, it's still a collector's item, right? It's an alternate version, but then we will remake it, and based on demand, based on customer feedback or whatever, retailer orders, we will make more of the next time. And so if you want one, just sit tight. It's all good.
It's the first rule of power, Johnny. You always keep the masses in the dark.
Yeah, I guess.
Thanks, Kim Jong-un.
We should probably wrap this up because none of the four of us have even purchased an amiibo, sure. So we're not really the experts. Connectivity has good coverage of this. Anyway, I hope the focus of the conversation on amiibo takes a turn here in the new year, because at some point I can't take 18 months of scarcity stories. I can't.
Yeah.
It needs to be, why are these things scarce? And the answer has to be something other than because there aren't very many of them. If that continues and continues and continues to be the story, then Nintendo has failed. I mean, Wii was scarce for 2.5-3 years after it launched, but the reason it was scarce is because it was crazy and it did something awesome that people wanted so bad, and people kept telling each other about it, and the word of mouth was insane. And everybody said, well, I want to go get one of those things, right? It wasn't people buying it because it was hard to find. That was a tiny fraction of the sales. That was a small piece of the market. With amiibo, it seems like that's the only thing anybody's talking about. I think that's unfortunate.
So you're not an amiibo, is what you're saying?
No, definitely not.
So how about you amigo away from this show forever?
All right.
Hey, Guillaume, why don't you read the next email?
Sure. Stephen from Madison, Wisconsin writes, so, as part of the Sony Pictures email leak, it turns out that the CGI Mario movie appears to be in the works. In addition to your overall thoughts about the idea, I wanted to ask, who do you think should voice the characters? Is the standard game cast appropriate? Should they try to find the actors from the old cartoons? Are there any other voice actors you would pick? Feel free to mix sources to create your dream cast. Your dream cast. Yeah, sorry.
So we're going to create something that has nothing good in it, is what you're telling me. Okay. Hmm. I think the Hotel Mario cast is what we got to go with.
Come on.
I hope she has lots of spaghetti.
None of the voice actors from the video game should be involved with this.
Yeah. What? You don't think so? Why not? I can't hear anybody else's Mario other than Charles Martinet.
To me, I'm Martinet because he's the only Mario voice I recognize at this point.
Yeah, he's the only actor doing Mario voices. I think.
So
like who does Peach?
Here's the thing. He's the only one that I look at and say, okay. Like he puts real joy into that voice.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, of course he does. But here's the thing about Martinet, and I love the guy. He is an adorable person. He's so nice, and he's so talented. You know, I love seeing him do a dozen different characters in the span of a minute. You know, the thing is, Martinet was brought in for Mario 64, mm-hmm. and he was asked to say like three words at a time. You know, it's a lot of exclamations, it's a lot of grunts, it's a lot of laughing and surprise sounds and things like that. It's the kind of stuff that you hear from Link, right? And the reason that I don't think Martinet would be good for a movie is because presumably Mario is going to be speaking dialogue, like pages of script.
Yeah, it requires acting.
Well, and maybe it's more of a silent movie. You know,
so you have like the Rabbids show, which has no dialogue in it ever. There is not a single fucking spoken word in that show.
If it's like that, then Martinet's your guy. But if Mario is going to be speaking complete sentences here, I don't think it should be Charles Martinet.
But the point is, what the fuck's Mario going to say?
Yeah, I don't know,
James. You're asking me to guess the script
only,
of
the
this
only
movie.
Person who ever, the only people who ever fucking talk into Mario is Peach and Bowser. That's it. Mm-hmm. The only assholes that say anything in that series.
Yeah.
So is Leslie Swann still the voice of Peach, or was that?
Oh no, she hasn't been for a long time.
Oh okay.
She was in 64, but I think even by like GBA and DS era, I think she was, because I asked her about it one time and she said, "Oh, I haven't done that in years." So I don't remember who does it now, but it's not her.
Okay.
Yeah.
So now it might be an actual actress.
The funny thing is, Martinet could probably do Peach, but I don't know why he doesn't.
Yeah, I think you, for the spoken roles, you'd probably bring in, you know, voice actors, but I don't think Mario should really talk that much in this movie. I mean,
well, that's a fair point.
I think the movie should really just be physical comedy more than anything else, because ultimately, I don't necessarily understand how the movie functions at a deep level, but you could sort of go to, and I think this is probably the best place to look. You can go watch like an episode of that Rabbids show, and you could see, okay, they've managed to transpose that physical comedy of those characters into, you know, an adventure. They tell a story every time without talking. I think you could effectively do a very similar thing by just having the characters that do talk in that world, your Bowsers and your Peaches, do their exposition, say the dumb goofy stuff they say, and then just let Mario do action comedy and just have at it.
That's the thing, though. I don't really think that's really extending his character at all. Like, I mean,
why would you?
What more is that? I mean, that's just like an extended game cutscene.
Okay. Well, again,
you can't make a movie out of that, is what I'm saying. You know, there has to be plot dialogue to advance that plot.
John,
there
are Jackie Chan comedy movies from early in his career where he fucking says almost nothing.
Yeah.
Schwarzenegger used to do the same thing.
There's fucking Charlie Chaplin films that where he doesn't say anything, right? But I mean, I don't really think that would work in this case. I mean, I think there would have to be something.
John, your target audience is 8 and younger. You could totally get away with this.
And everybody that buys Amiibos?
This could totally, yeah. Oh. Well, I said 8 and younger. I said 8 and younger.
In most children's movies now, the characters won't shut up. So I'm not sure.
So I think we can all agree that this movie should be directed by Michel Hazanavicius from The Artist, and OSS 117. And John invoked Charlie Chaplin, which is, you know, I thought about the same thing. And the fact is there aren't many people nowadays who can actually make that kind of thing work.
Yeah, but I mean, why do that when that's already been done in the games effectively? Why make a movie out of that?
I agree. To me, it should be a little different. It should bring you should get an experience out of the movie that you cannot get from a game. It should and I'm not saying it should tell like a really complex story, but I tell you what I would love is, and I'm thinking back to the animated series. You know, there were multiple back in the late 80s and you know, most of the 90s, there were Super Mario cartoons. And to me, a lot of times they didn't work that great and they weren't that much fun to watch because, you know, they spent a good bit of time on character scenes, you know, where Mario would talk to Peach and whatever.
That shit needs to not be there.
That stuff was bad, you know, and as I got older, as a teenager, I couldn't, it was like Power Rangers, like, oh, I can't watch this anymore. This used to be whatever, and then I would wait for the action scene, but now the dialogue part is so grating that I can't handle it anymore and I can't watch it. But then when they went to the action scenes in those old Mario cartoons, you never really had a sense of the gravity that you have when you play the games. In other words, there'd be some obstacle arranged for Mario or Luigi or whoever to overcome, but it felt like they would just eat a mushroom or whatever, and then they could just jump as high as they possibly wanted to, and they could just do whatever. And I feel like in a movie especially, if you're going to try to design action scenes for Mario, which it has to have a bunch of, maybe that's all it is, but it has to have a bunch of it, you need to have a sense that Mario is a powerful character, but he has limitations, and there are restrictions on what he can do, and there are challenges for him. There are things that will happen in the movie that he doesn't feel confident that he's going to be able to get through, and then you have to overcome that somehow. And so to me, the fun part is, what if you see these things from more of Mario's perspective? What if the camera angle is kind of over his shoulder?
First person Mario movie.
No. But more where you see more of what Mario sees, and you see, you know, that stairway that goes up to the flagpole seems really high because it's like 10 times higher than his height.
So,
and how is he ever going to jump over that gap? Well, of course he has an amazing jumping ability, but you have some sense of, well, you know how far he can jump, and that gap seems longer. So he has to find some creative way of overcoming that. And that's kind of what those games are about. And to me, those action scenes in the movie, they need to kind of grab at what makes people enjoy the games, which is the challenge. And the problem with those cartoons is that Mario is kind of all-powerful, right? So he need to feel a little bit more real, a little bit more challenged by these situations.
But I look at it this way. In my mind, there should be almost none of the character exposition, because it doesn't really fucking matter. It should be quick hits. And I mean, this way, once your characters start talking in your video game series, you've got fucking Sonic Boom the TV show. And that's a problem. No, that's what you fucking got, Guillaume, because that show was goddamn terrible.
I think you could have like the basic kind of progression of something like The Wizard of Oz and start from there, you know, like they're uprooted from Brooklyn, but wherever they're from, and they land in a land of toads asking for their help, and then, you know, like they climb gigantic vines, and I think that you can have some character stuff. Like, they're going to have to save the world.
Yeah.
Like, that's kind of a given. And for the action stuff, I kind of imagine, like, Mario doing parkour.
Yeah.
Like, something like that.
Do you guys remember that Flash movie? I don't remember what the title was, but it was about Mario and Luigi, like, having to defeat Koopa. And it was all done with the sprite graphics, but arranged in Flash to make it felt like really big and dramatic and epic. And at times there were like hundreds of Koopa Troopas on the screen. It looked like an army.
Right.
And it was like Mario versus the Koopa army. And it actually looked really intimidating. And to me, the thing is, that thing is great because it's still silly. I mean, again, Mario is inherently absurd. So it doesn't matter how serious you try to make it, it's going to look crazy. So you might as well kind of go with it and make it feel, it has to feel like whatever quest he's on or whatever thing he's trying to do, it's meaningful to him. It's meaningful to these characters within that context. Hmm.
So for the voice acting, what, like the cast of Firefly, or what are we thinking of? Zach Braff as Luigi.
Bradley Cooper.
I mean, this way, I would be thrilled if Mario doesn't say a goddamn word this whole movie. Like, other people can talk, and that's fine. But Mario doesn't have anything to fucking say. His job is to jump on shit.
I see a ton of cliche plot threads in my head right now. Like, just like the whole interaction between the brothers and like Mario's successful one.
Yeah, that shit's awful. That shit was terrible in the movie, in the shows. If you put it in there, you will fail at making this movie good. Hmm. Fundamentally, if you have,
but
like,
you're making a movie for kids. Ideally, it should be good, but
kids will not respond to a shitty movie.
But they do respond to cliche storylines. They don't
to an extent. They're not bothered by that. Kids are somewhat sophisticated. They get bored if they've seen stuff before.
Yeah, if you're three, nothing is cliched because you haven't seen anything enough for it to become a cliche.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, cliche is all context. It's all
history.
My point
is, those movies that succeed, those CG movies that succeed at a really high level succeed because they appeal across age demographics.
Yeah. And that's going to be, it's going to be tough.
But, I mean, the other point is, it's really based on who's making this. Because, I mean,
Sony.
Like, let's get, like, David O. Russell through to direct this. With the cast of American Hustle. I think I've sold it.
Yeah. Hey, I would watch that in a heartbeat. All right. Well, let's move on, though. I'm going to read the next email. This is from Evan, who writes, the 3DS had a fantastic 2013, no doubt about it, and we've seen a plateau of 3DS sales, at least judging by the sales I've seen and the recent article published by NWR. So my question is, how does Nintendo make the launch, however soft or hard, of the new 3DS in America and PAL, the PAL territories, Europe, a reason worth investing in?
Monster Launch Hunter, so hard, girl.
Monster Hunter is a reason for Japanese people to go wild, but the game doesn't have the sort of, that sort of presence here, and I don't see Codename Steam, Monster Hunter, Majora's Mask, or a Phoenix Wright spinoff justifying the launch. Excuse me. In my opinion, a heavy push on the amiibo capabilities of the console is going to be the selling point, as well as an increased investment in the American market, because we all love those toys. I don't know about all. Okay, guys, so what do you think? How do they make this thing worth investing in?
Announce a fucking game for it. I mean, well, Jesus.
They did, man. They did Xenoblade.
They announced Chronicles. Endgame.
Endgame, yeah.
Announce games, I mean, for it. Like, make this thing actually worth owning. Right now, in Japan, it's selling off the fact that it's A, Japan's fucking nuts, and B, that there is, it is a functionally better system. I mean, in Japan, there is this infinite appetite for buying 3DS variants.
Yeah.
Right, but like, it's functionally better, but it doesn't have any unique features so far that really make it stand out. Like, the DSi, I think, was a success for Nintendo, but I think that was mostly because of the cameras. Like, the kids would go nuts.
Well,
they're
able to sell it as, look, this thing has an online shop. There were some games worth getting on it. I mean, it felt like, okay, this is a bigger iteration of hardware than just, hey, here's a repackaged DS.
Right.
So the new 3DS is a bigger iteration of hardware than a repackaged 3DS, but they don't tell us why it matters.
Yeah, I agree.
And that's the problem they've got right now.
Yeah.
Well, and that's probably why they're waiting to announce it, or part of the reason. You know, I think they're not going to announce the release of this thing, the launch, in other territories until they have more to back it up, because they know it's not going to fly in North America if all they've got to show for it is a port of Xenoblade, which they barely released here.
But why Australia then?
We've discussed this. Let's not get back into that. Well, it's probably just a product surplus situation. I think for the major release outside of Japan, which will be in North America and Europe, I think they're going to want something more substantial to show, and that's why they haven't done it yet. I'm sure in the next month, at the most, within the next month, we will hear more about this, probably in January.
Yeah, they really need a hook. They need a hook game on this thing.
Yeah.
They need at least three games, in my mind.
Yeah, I mean, not including Majora's Mask 3D, because I mean that's
Smash, which does have some additional support here, but by the time that thing comes out here, Smash 3DS will be at least 5 months old.
Yeah.
Well, and nobody's talking about it, and I don't think they can really juice interest in Smash 3DS by saying now you can use the C-stick.
Right.
I don't think most people care.
It's funny because the C-stick is something that people have been asking for so long, but unless games come out that use the thing, like, it's not going to matter. The C-stick does work. Like, it does replace the, what's the stupid name? Controller Pro? Like, the DS...
Yeah.
So it does... Yeah, the Circle Pad Pro. So it does replace that. So it's backwards compatible, but there's not enough of those games to matter.
No, of course not. There's almost none, so... To me, what would be nice is if they announce some third-party stuff they're saying, hey, these are companies that wanted to make 3DS games, but the stuff they wanted to do wasn't really possible because they were, you know, it wasn't powerful enough, or there weren't enough controls on it. And so now they are much more free to bring these really cool experiences to the 3DS that they haven't done in the past. And, you know, show Geometry Wars 3 on running on new 3DS, you know, show a new Resident Evil that has all that stuff built in, show a first-person shooter or something. I mean, anything you can think of that actually needs two joysticks or extra shoulder buttons, I think that would go a long way.
Pool Blocks 3!
But, you know...
that would be great, but they have to show the games. They can't just have, like, a bunch of logos and, like, Saints Row and 3DS, you know, because we've seen that before. We've heard that before.
Of course. And then the Amiibo thing is not actually an exclusive feature of this thing. I mean, it'll be more convenient if you have a new 3DS, but they are selling that portal supposedly at some point for the older 3DSs. And so I don't know that that's a super strong selling point there. I think it's going to need to be more like there's a whole other mode that only works on this because it's more powerful, you know, and to me, that's really how they have to sell it. And the DSi, although technically more powerful than a DS, the DSi was never sold on the premise that it's more powerful. It had features built in. It had this shop of games that you could buy, and that was intriguing to certain people. But I think in this case, from what we know, from what little we know, it seems like the new 3DS is way more powerful than the 3DS. And I think they really need to not only make that the emphasis of their launch and why people should want it, but also they need to show games that prove it.
Just announce the next Pokemon game for it. Be done. Just say the next Pokemon game is coming on new 3DS. We know that means you have to buy a new 3DS. Go buy it.
Certainly will not be exclusive, but I think it will be a dual mode game. I think the next Pokemon will certainly have things that you can only do on a new 3DS. Mm-hmm. Probably Amiibo stuff.
No, I think the Amiibo stuff will probably allow the portal support because they want to sell that plastic figurine too.
Yeah, of course.
So, I mean, to me, they just need to put... I mean, it really comes down to, okay, show me something. Because right now, in terms of 3DS games, there's not a ton of them on the horizon right now.
Mm-hmm.
Any game that's big enough for, you know, to be really a system important game, are they going to announce it in March or February? Are they going to just hold it a few more months and announce it in June at E3?
I think it depends on when it's coming out. I mean, I think they're going to want to launch this system before E3. So announcing games at E3 doesn't work. They need to do it before that.
Right. But the question is, are they going to be able to get the run they want to get out of these games if they announce them in February and release them in April?
Yeah, sure. If it's a big deal. If they do their jobs, then yeah, it can be. I don't see why not. You know, what about, like, we've heard that there might be a new Diddy Kong Racing or something like that. You know, I mean, maybe that can only be run with the power of the new 3DS. You know, I mean, there's things that are probably recognizable that would get people excited.
F-Zero, new 3DS exclusive.
Whoa, now that would be really interesting.
I don't think it would do their move the needle, though, which is the other part of the equation. Like,
get me to buy one, for sure.
What do they announce that moves the needle? Like, what gets a significant portion of their 3DS current base really hyped up?
Yeah, and that they wouldn't want to be, that they would be okay with having exclusive as well.
Right. It's a weird trade-off they've got to work here.
Yeah.
Well, and it may very well be that the first 6 to 12 months of releases on this thing are primarily dual mode games, you know? So, I mean, mm-hmm. there may be one or two exclusives, but not much. But then if the system picks up, if they manage to convince people on the, you know, the overall merits of the new system and all, you know, the better 3D and stuff like that, maybe they, once they build up kind of enough critical mass, then they can justify doing exclusive games. But, you know, I mean, I agree that I think they need exclusive games announced for it. I don't necessarily expect that there's going to be a bunch, but I do think there will be games that they were going to release anyway. They will be playable on the older systems. They'll just be in some way much better. And they need to be specific about that. And they need to say, we're not saving this feature for the new system just because we want you to buy the new system. It's because the old system could not do it. And that's the perfect way to explain to the audience why they need this new system. It's because it does things the old one doesn't do. And those things need to be things that you want it to do, you know, and it, and that needs to be in, wrapped up in the context of a game that you want to play. And I just don't think they're going to be announcing tons of exclusives for this thing in the early goings. I hope it's successful enough eventually that they can do that later. But, you know, it's stuff like Majora's Mask and Smash, you know, all that, you know, you can totally play that on older systems. It's just better. And the stuff that, to me, what they've done in Smash that we know of, is that's not nearly enough. You know, that's, it's all,
right.
It's not even bells and whistles. It's like, well, it boots faster.
Right.
You know, I mean, it's just, no, that's not meaningful to
anybody. It's the symphony equivalent of the triangle player. Just get out. I mean, you could do, you could attempt the strategy of just sort of pack the market with B-tier titles. And just say, okay, here's three or four B-level franchises that we have that are exclusive or semi-exclusive. So you could say, to get us what, you could do an F-Zero, although I would think you'd want to do an F-Zero as a console game right now.
Right.
But
well, F-Zero is actually an interesting one because, I mean, they could probably make that in fairly short order, and they don't seem to care about having it around anyways, so it's the kind of game where I don't think that they would mind having it exclusive on something because they don't.
Yeah, what it if... would be that system's Pilot Wings.
Yeah, or Ridge Racer.
What? No, John, no, no.
Yeah, I just went there.
All right. But let's say all right. They target three or four franchises they're not really using right now,
like Professor Layton.
Well, they don't own Layton though.
No, but they can.
They would have to get level 5 to make a Layton game. But level five will make a Layton game on their own. They like money. Nintendo doesn't need to get involved in that.
Well, also that I think level 5 and Professor Layton is a great example, I think, of a series that is in need of a reason for a new game to come out. Because, you know, the old formula of the way that those games are made seems to be a little played. People are kind of complaining that the games are too similar, and even the weird experiment that they already tried with Phoenix Wright wasn't a huge success outside of Japan. So, you know, it's a valuable franchise for Level 5, and they would like a way to bring it back that makes people excited and want to buy it. I mean, putting it on the new system might be the way to do it.
Well, I think in their heads right now, the best way to do that is give that franchise a little bit of airtime to just kind of chill out for a while. But, I mean,
that's effectively what they've done already, though.
Yeah, but in the West, it's only been happening for about 6 months. Like, it's still fairly fresh. So I would imagine they're going to give that one a little bit more time. To me, the run here is, all right, let's just say Nintendo's in-house stuff. All right, so they haven't made an F-Zero game in a while. They've already got a Star Fox game coming, so that's out. But what if they just started just straight dump porting other console games? Like, they just said, all right, we're just going to port 3 GameCube games to this thing.
That's
not going to sell systems, yeah. Though. I mean, it's
but
you're. I mean, you're preaching to the converted at that point because I mean nobody.
But here's the thing: the new 3DS is selling to the converted. That's its first target market. It has to do. They have to get the converted, the dyed in the wool on this thing.
Yeah,
because
I don't
right
think
now they don't have any reason to buy the damn thing.
But I mean, that's the whole thing. If you're talking about the dyed in the wool, they probably all own those GameCube games anyway. So it's not like that's some huge incentive unless they want to buy it again.
Well, they own Majora's Mask, but they're going to buy that again.
Well, yeah. But he's talking about just straight porting it. I mean, it's not really enhancing anything.
Well, I mean, building it up for the 3DS. But
well,
yeah.
Of course, it'll have 3D and the new system. That's probably its best feature, at least you know from first blush. Is hey, the 3D is way better. So you know, adding 3D to old games and then making it such that everybody wants to play it in 3D. That you know. Maybe that's a big deal. You put out Super Mario Sunshine 3D, and then suddenly people are like, hey, that sounds pretty good. Also, I remember liking that game, and I haven't touched it in a long time. And that's a game that pretty much requires two joysticks.
You're just trying to build that platform enough that you can then take the risk and take a bigger franchise and say, we're going to make this exclusively for the new 3DS. That's your objective, to get that system to the point where you can make a big game only for that system and convert everybody else. And it's a process they're going to have to build because they're not saying this is a console generation split.
It's in a way it's the old third pillar problem from when they first introduced
the DS. It's exactly what it is in a lot of ways.
It's going to be interesting to see how they handle it this time. I mean, last time I felt like
when they hit that point where they're just like GBA just die.
Well, yeah, because the DS became popular almost despite their efforts, I felt like, you know, almost despite the library for a long time. And really a lot on the basis of third-party games out of Japan. I don't know if you guys remember this, but like I remember the summer of 2005. It was the first summer after DS came out. Mm-hmm. The American releases were still garbage. I mean, there was almost nothing good coming out. But in Japan, all of a sudden you had Kirby Canvas Curse and you had the new Castlevania and you had Meteos and you had all this crazy stuff and it was so
good. Sonic Rush, I think, also came out.
Sonic Rush was that year. Yep. And then all of a sudden it felt like, whoa, there's like a serious library of games here.
But yeah.
That's not going to happen the same way with 3DS.
Right.
A lot of those companies aren't even making handheld games.
Well, and the other extension here is you have a platform that is effectively, it says there's not that novelty of the DS two screen clamshell crazy.
Yeah, it's not as different. And, you know, I think the branding, we've talked about the name, but the branding is going to be critical here. I think we all agree that new 3DS is a terrible name that they should not use, and they might do it anyway. But if they want to set this apart as something different, something much better, something that you need to have, I think
4DS.
You
know,
sure. Mm-hmm. Sure. Sure.
Actually, to make sense now, like it would be 3DS, 2DS, it should be the 1DS.
No, that was like, the
fuck
DS.
Fuck everything.
It could be as easy as just calling it the 3DSi in the West. Maybe that's good enough. But there's already a lot of confusion, and my sister asked me about this. She called me, she said, hey, does her new 2DS play 3DS games? Because it didn't. I looked at she's like, I saw a Frozen game for 3DS and it didn't say anything about 2DS and I wasn't sure if it would play on her system. I said, it does, but I understand why you're confused. Now add on top of that a new system called New 3DS that does have games that don't play on the other ones. It's a recipe
but, you
for
know,
disaster
the way they handled
at the
it,
retail space.
The way they handled it with the Game Boy Color. Because this is actually a little bit closer to that, because you have this weird, like, backwards-forwards compatibility thing of maybe 90% of the library, but then you have this subset that it's just not. Is they made those game boxes, you know, if it was a Game Boy Color designed game, it had that whole different, you know, spine design to it.
Yeah, the goofy
kind of Game Boy Color exclusive game, it got even crazier. Mm-hmm. I think that's probably what they're going to have to do. And, I mean, they've been doing that kind of branding with pretty much every system for the last 3 or 4 systems they've got, so they could very easily just style that thing super hardcore and say new 3DS only and pull it off. But it's gonna
it's got holograms and a blinking light.
Yeah, it's gonna take a little bit of doing. I mean,
make impractical star shaped boxes and sell the games in there.
No. The PS3 already did that with impractical box shapes. We're fine.
All right. Well, yeah. Let's move on. There's one more short email to read this week.
All right. Here's what we got. All right, so apparently I was the only one that could read this properly. I don't really know what that means, but
I can't read. That's why.
But I know that, James, from doing Now Playing. Friendly neighborhood drug dealer writes, so recently I was playing Smash 3DS online when I came across a most peculiar opponent. Instead of starting off the match by going in for an attack, they taunted me constantly, ducking and jumping. Intrigued, I approached him apprehensively. Yet still, he did not attack. My curiosity piqued, I mimicked his actions, and as the hours passed, I felt a bond forming. Being in the drug business since I was a wee tyke. Doesn't really sound like a drug dealer to me, but I heard a lot of stories. My current situation reminded me of an old suburban legend where two drug dealers found themselves occupying the same street for business. But instead of dueling to the death as is tradition, they got high off of each other's supply and made love into the moonlight. Under the moonlight. Into the moonlight? Nah, dog. However, unlike my contemporaries, I could not make love into the moonlight. Really like making love in the moonlight. I would have to fight him to the death. This realization made my love turn to violence, and I was forced to murder him/her in cold blood. Were you guys ever in a similar situation in an online game? And what do you think of an online mode in Smash where you could choose to fight each other or work together/make love?
It's like I was actually playing 187 Ride or Die. Thank you, John.
Yeah, you made that actually worse than it was in my head when I read it.
I thought that's what I'm here thought for. I thought I detected a hint of Red Serling in there. It's really weird.
My deepest concern now is that I just gave somebody flashbacks to playing 187 Ride or Die. I'm sorry.
I wish I could do a Carl Sagan voice so I could redo that in Carl Sagan's voice. I think that would be hilarious. But anyway, I don't know if this is a real question or not. I mean, it's in the name of the game. You have to fight.
I disagree. Mm-hmm. I played a round of Smash Brothers recently where combat was rendered effectively impossible.
You could play a timed match and just let time run out, but I think you'd still go to sudden death and you'd still, again... Bad thing. I mean, sudden death. Somebody has to die.
Almost like a game of chicken. Who wants to not
die first?
You could play
on a real Smash Brothers stage with hazards, as opposed to a fake one that doesn't have hazards, and effectively do nothing, and somebody would eventually win. Eventually, a stage hazard would take you out.
Maybe something with two shooting barrels and bumpers.
Yeah, so
James, maybe?
I made a stage designed for our Gust Bellows configuration of Smash Brothers play. Where the barrels just shoot you off the stage anyway, but I've actually modified it now to play with high frequency bumpers only, and no one can fight in that. You can't get near the other person because there's 37 bumpers on the stage. It's pacifism. I mean, it's like being an authentic pacifist during a war. You get your shit run over. So it's I think that's kind of what they're going for here. Just bumpers only, final destination, and you're good to go. Everything's fine.
Wonderful.
I didn't throw a punch the entire match because I couldn't get to the person I was trying to hit.
There's your answer to everything. All your Smash Brothers problems. Just more bumpers.
More bumpers. I wish you could put bumpers in the stage. Bumper.
That is street knowledge right there. Head gold, head if gold. You will.
That's head gold. All right. Well, thanks everyone for writing in your emails. Like I said, we do have quite a few really good ones that we still haven't gotten to, so we'll try to catch up on those next week. We don't know exactly what's going on with the production schedule. It's kind of tough here with the holidays coming up. It's going to be tricky to get together and do a show, but we're going to try to find some time to do that. It might be a shorter show. We're going to try to get something for you, so please stay patient, and if not, we will be back early in the new year with another episode. So we will continue to need your emails, so please do feel free to get in touch with us at rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. And otherwise, happy holidays, everybody. Enjoy. I hope you get some time off.
Happy holidays, everybody.
Joyous fight.